Hi, and welcome to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Steve Martorano. Join us each week as we speak to experts in the behavioral health field, fostering diverse and meaningful conversation on substance abuse and mental health. We are, as I've told you many times, underwritten by the good people at Retreat Behavioral Health. So when we say we're going to get some expert opinions about stuff, we're not kidding. We always reach out to our great patrons because they have an incredible, incredible staff. They have recently expanded their portfolio to go well beyond treating substance abuse to now treating standalone mental health issues. Now, very often the two things go hand in hand, but we're going to kind of focus on the one aspect of that, and that is the mental health aspect. From a deep, I think, macro view, what are we talking about? We talk about mental problems. How is it treated? And then a little later in the program, we're going to get a little more specific about something that's alarmingly rising in our culture among, well, it says most of the literature talks about adolescents, but I suspect we'll find out it's not just young people. It's self-harm. You probably are more familiar with the phenomenon of people who cut themselves. So we're going to talk about that straight ahead as well. All of that on this edition of Recovery Radio. To facilitate it all, we have with us Tom Longenecker. Tom is a clinical specialist at Retreat in their Lancaster facility, and we welcome him back to the program. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
Tom was with us during the Fall Fest when we lassoed him in the middle of the festivities to sit down and get acquainted with him. We're going to do that in greater depth right now. So Tom, before we get into what you do, let's talk about how long you've been doing it and some of your background.
Sure. I've worked in this field across more than 20 years. That doesn't mean consistently, but let's see, 96. So do the math there. What is that?
It's 23 years.
23 years or so. So across the field, across that span of time.
You know, as I get older, I have a more difficult time doing that math.
Yeah.
Because I go, no, that couldn't have been 30 years ago. How could that have been 30? Yeah, that's 23 years, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I came into the field. I kind of fell into it. I needed to wrap up some field education for a master's degree.
And so that's part of your credentials.
Right.
For people who don't know what they should look for in terms of credentialing, if they're looking for a mental health clinician, what are your credentials and licensing in regard to that?
Sure. Because I work in a facility, the facility itself is credentialed. So I have a master's and then completed doctoral work. And then my certifications are just, certified advanced alcohol drug dependency, drug KDAC, international and but.
I always see, anytime I have a clinician on, I see all those letters after their
names.
Right,
right.
So people should ask about this.
They should ask about that. So mine are KDAC, IKDAC, American Pastoral Care Counselors. Other people might have an LPC, licensed professional counseling degree, certification, or licensed clinical social worker or clinical social worker. Those are pretty much the standard kinds of professional licensures that you're looking for. Beyond that, some people might have a PhD or a PsyD in kind of some mental health or helping profession field. But those are kind of the standards that I would look for.
What that is a tough question, I realize, maybe, but I'm sure you'll tackle it. Do you have a sort of general philosophy on how you treat your patients?
Yeah. I think I look to an author named Frederick Buechner, and in one of his passages, he talks about listening to your life. And so I really see a large part of my task is to help people learn how to listen to their lives. What are the patterns in your life that are going on? If you can pay attention to the patterns, as opposed to just experiencing life flooding over you, if you can pay attention to the things that happen in my life, my role in those things, and if you can really start to listen to that, it has a message for you that, you know, and you do something differently from that, you know, what we call that is wisdom. And so a large part of my task I really see is really just a facilitator, just to help people really be able to listen more closely and intelligently and intimately within their own lives and their story.
Yeah, you're making that sound easier than it is.
Perhaps.
For sure. I mean, you mentioned listening.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody who interviews folks,
certainly.
One of the hallmarks of a really bad interview, and I can hear it, is when the guy's not listening or the interviewer's not listening, they're forming the next question,
mm-hmm.
or they want to make a speech, or they want to sort of direct things. So listening's really important. But it's not I would guess that in your field, it's not the most important thing, because you also do have to shape the direction in which they're going to lead you to listen. Sure. I mean, you can't listen to bad things, right? How does that work for you? How do you get somebody on track?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think some of that is, and you're totally right, part of the benefits of a inpatient facility such as this is it slows things down, so I as a person or you as a person have greater opportunity to let some of the white noise fade away, so I can actually pay more attention to my life, because there's just so many other things that keep people distracted. So one piece is trying to develop some of that slowing things down. The other is I bring plenty of prompts that are intended to help guide people, plenty of different kinds of projects and other things that people are working on, timelines and genograms and other kinds of things that are intentionally intended to help them along the way, to give them some tools to open this up.
So most of us who have not had mental health problems, much less mental health treatment, form our opinions about what the process is all about, largely through the media, motion pictures in particular. Mm-hmm. And the image of this process is you come in, the psychiatrist or psychologist sits in a chair, you either sit on a couch or lie on a couch. Is any of that accurate?
I'm sure it is in different circumstances. If I'm leading a group of patients, I rarely would be sitting down. And if I'm sitting down, there's a purpose to it. But there, large part of my task there is I'm really trying to build the group. And if I can start to step out of that, if I become less important in it through the cross arc of the group, that's good. Individually, that's going to look different from place to place, from one session to another session. Early on, I'm really trying just to build a safe place for the patient.
Well, how do you do that? What role does trust have in the dynamic?
I don't know that there's anything more important than building a relationship of trust where the person begins to build a sense of safety. We don't have a lot of markers in our world that affirm safety, or what you bring is enough. I don't get paid before I do my work. I get paid 2 weeks later. Nobody's saying, we think you're going to show up and do your best and bring your best. We're gonna affirm that first.
Right.
So we don't have a lot of guides. We don't have a lot of practices in our society that really kind of affirm somebody from the beginning. So I think building that place where somebody can start to stretch out, where they can start to breathe a little bit, that can happen just simply, again, just by asking questions, just getting a person to tell their story. I also do a good bit of guided meditation kind of work, which usually tells somebody how that's a good guide in terms of how available are they to even let themselves rest, let themselves be trusted.
Can you describe what you mean when you say guided meditation?
Guided meditation, some people think it's hypnosis. It really isn't. And really what I'm doing is just paying attention to breathing. I can do more complex things, but I generally hardly ever do that. It's just really becoming acquainted with what it's like to sit in a chair, being aware of what's going on around you, be aware of what's going on in your body, paying attention to breath. And just even that process is something that the people I work with often, not always, but often, it just changes the whole, it's a practice of learning how to be aware.
Yeah.
But it just changes the whole sense of peace and groundedness.
Well, shutting out the noise of everyday life in our, I mean, the actual noise and then the noise in our heads, slowing that down, quieting that down is, I guess, the central goal of meditation to begin with, right?
Certainly. And largely what I'm doing there is I'll just try to normalize the things that could interrupt them. So we're not even trying to necessarily shut it out, but I'll mention before we do this, I'll remind them, here's certain kind of noises, certain things that can interrupt you. And then we recognize that at some point I get to choose, does that interrupt me or does that flow through me? And so some of that is simply around I can come back to being aware of just myself in this chair or myself sitting here or my breath or even just the mechanics of the rise and fall of my chest as I breathe.
That's fascinating because I've read about meditation. I know people who meditate. I've read descriptions of meditation as being life-altering and I couldn't get through a day without it. And the idea I have in my head is that you go into a room, a quiet place, maybe there's a candle or maybe there isn't. And maybe you say a mantra, or maybe you don't. But the idea is to slow all that process down and get centered and quiet. And I have always felt, I just don't think I could do that. How can you shut out all the stuff in your head. And I think I heard you just say that that's not really the goal.
You're going to have stuff in your head. And I think a large part of that is simply to recognize those are just thoughts. And you can kind of anchor them off to the side for a little bit and just bring your attention back to some really basic things.
Does it help someone in a therapeutic situation like that where they're trying to slow down, get their breath under control, quiet their stuff down, that when the thoughts intrude, it's important that they recognize that a thought just intruded and not get hung, get sidetracked?
Because they're just thoughts. You haven't failed. When I talk with people about doing these kind of exercises, I'm very clear. It's almost impossible for you to fail at this. Now, people who really want to develop meditation can finesse that. They can become more skilled at it. But really, at that point, there's really no way to fail because you're simply becoming aware. And I can become aware of these thoughts that come in, my grocery list or these other issues in my life. And you simply recognize them for what they are. And also just simply, again, return to, I'm just going to become more aware of my breath, my breathing. I think one of the challenges my patients have is that this can become one more escape. And, we need places to escape. We need little places to escape. But when that becomes a lifelong venture, when that becomes a key part of life, that's really one way to just really understand addiction is I'm escaping things.
Yeah.
We need a Friday night to veg out with Netflix. That's fine. But one of the keys is meditation or these kind of grounding exercises can be escape. But if it's only that, that's probably not enough. And so another way to look at it is a grounding or refuge, a way to step back so that I can actually
begin the process
and I can then come back and engage my life with it from this place of being.
Yeah, that's interesting because I know a lot of people think, oh, good, you go into a room and you escape everything. And it's certainly not the goal. So Tom, it's sort of like the golden age of, I guess every period of time thinks it's the golden age of crazy. There are enormous pressures on people, anxiety, depression, all of that. Give us sort of a shopping list of some of the things you're seeing from your people.
Sure. Well, of course, depression, anxiety are significant, so common. A good number of our patients come in actively suicidal or just coming from a suicidal episode. We'll also see people with other kind of more access to kind of diagnoses, borderline personality disorder, bipolarity. These are not uncommon. Also kind of the schizoid range, schizoaffective, schizoid, schizophrenia. These are kind of, those are some of the things that we'll see also. But the vast majority really is in the range of depression, anxiety, and suicidality.
Yeah. Yeah. We make clear for people who are looking for help, and again, we point out there's lots of places to get it, but to be clear about what goes on at a place like Retreat, who now have a broader portfolio regarding mental health issues. This is not a psych hospital situation.
If you're thinking of Girl Interrupted or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, this would not be what we're doing. That would be more of a, higher acute level of locked wards.
Right.
Now, our patients are up and out, walking out and about in the outside, going up to different parts of the campus. So images. That's not what we're about.
Yeah. Well, if you need any kind of help or you're feeling anxious at all, please don't use Cuckoo's Nest. I mean, it's one of my favorite movies, but it's not exactly should be your introduction to mental health treatment. So let's when we talk about things like anxiety and depression, which I think are probably the most common occurring situations that people might be familiar with, in your professional opinion, when do those things become a disorder rather than just a normal course of living?
Some of that is a matter of when I'm not able to function. My life is uncontrollable. There's just too much. There's too much. And probably the time to really get treatment would probably be before that. But even with that, sometimes depression simply grows or the anxiety is just overwhelming. But I think some of the gauges of that are where it's really truly interrupting my lifestyle, my life, my job, my relationships, my ability to maintain some kind of semblance of cohesiveness in my life.
I mean, there are people who, anxiety is sort of an evolutionary process. There were times and there are times still now when people should be anxious. And so when you say should get help before it becomes debilitating, how does somebody recognize that their anxiety is now ratcheted up?
Well, I think you make a good reference. Just in human development, anxiety was helpful because you're looking for the thing that can hurt me.
Yeah, don't mess up.
Okay, right. And so it has an evolutionary edge.
Yep.
The problem is when I'm looking at the world as ongoingly unsafe, that's not really being able to be grounded in reality, and I approach the world, I approach relationships with a sense of trepidation across the board, as opposed to where you can really break that down and say, this is an occasion to be fearful. This is an occasion not to be so fearful.
Right.
And really the biggest issue isn't even anxiety, but how I navigate and how I swim through it and the discord that it leads, the kind of fracturing of my sense of self.
Yeah. Well, here's my question. I'm a big believer in reasons, which is what separates us from houseplants. Why is reason by itself not enough for somebody suffering from even depression? I'm depressed. I know I'm depressed. I know there's no reason to be depressed or anxious, but I can't snap out of it.
Well, I think there's a couple ways to look at that. One is obviously reason is not enough. Or addiction and other mental issues often are in the face of reason. Despite what would be a reasonable or rational response, I continue to do this at behavior, or I continue to feel this way.
Even though I know it's irrational to behave this way.
Correct.
Right. So it's interesting. The reason, which is what we use to, get us through any situation, it is the least likely thing to get you through something like that.
And also because depression, anxiety will affect my capacity to reason.
Right. In other words, the tool you want to use is in defect.
Because depression is often recognized by, a heaviness, a numbness, a lack of feeling, and my thoughts run that way too. They run darker. They just run in a negative, very criticizing, self-criticizing way.
Yeah.
You tell me, Tom, you should feel so good about
yourself. What are you depressed about?
Right. Look at all these things that you're good at. Right. Okay. And what I'm thinking inside is, if you only knew.
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely. So I know from a brief conversation we had before I had you on the program that there's a component of your philosophy with regard to how to treat these problems that goes well beyond pure reason and goes into the realm of spirituality. When people hear that, they think, uh-oh, he's going to God me on this thing, and I've prayed and it's not working. What do you mean when you say there's a spiritual component to this?
And I think one of the ways I use that term, and then what I'm looking at is really a reconnection with, or a connection with, kind of the inner identity that a person carries around. And much of what's lost in addiction or depression or anxiety is a disconnection with my sense of self. And so a lot of what we're working around is to both recognize depression is not a part of me. Anxiety is not a part of me. It might kind of come visit me. It might have been a companion. It might be a really long-standing companion. So part of that is to recognize the difference between me, what I carry around with me, and the effects of, and you can kind of fill in the blank, addiction, depression, anxiety, suicidality, in terms of how that speaks to me. So to kind of bring that outside of me. The other piece of spirituality is really just looking at where are the true underlying values that make me who I am? And recognizing again that depression, anxiety, suicidality, addiction, fill in the blank, often steal those things.
Mm-hmm.
It can be that, one of the values I carry is that I'm compassionate, but I don't express that to myself. I don't maybe not express that to others. I really think, when I'm really who I am, I'm somebody who I'm an artist, and I draw, I do art. And that has gone by the wayside.
Right, right.
And so part of spirituality is, I just heard this from one of my patients this last week, I'm back to me.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the great descriptions of the distinction you draw between sort of religion and spirituality. So, Tom, we spent a good deal of time. We're going to get into the self-harm thing. And this will dovetail, I think, nicely. So we've heard about your side of the equation. We know what's going on the other side of the table. As someone who walks in, who's struggling for whatever situation, what are some of the things that a person looking for help should bring with them to, besides their problems, bring with them to this process? And I'm thinking in particular about how early on do you find it necessary to establish or to ask the patient, what are your goals?
Mm-hmm. I'll do that really at the very beginning, because really what I'm interested in is what brings you here. And that kind of sets up a conversation about what's been going on that makes you think that you would like to turn some corners, you would like to see something different. And so even just reflecting on what's been going on is often a really good, that really feeds trying to determine, well, what do I want to get out of this time here? What are the things I want to move towards? And so I'll do that really at the very beginning.
And what are there unrealistic goals that people set?
And at that point, I'm not that interested in being unrealistic or not. At that point,
we just want to hear them.
At that point, we really just want to. I think one of the most important things a person can bring is just bring your story. Tell because so much of this healing is learning how to tell my story true, and so be able to bring as much as I can, and that unfolds. There's more to be told. There's always more to be told. But at that point, we're just really trying to identify what's been going on with you. What are some of the stressors? What are some things you would like to return to in life? What are some things you'd like to see happening in your life? Mm-hmm. And it's really important that the person be able to like name that for themselves.
Have you ever had a situation where people are in front of you, know they should be, but don't know why, can't exactly tell you?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, because and part of that's just saying is things have been so confusing. I can't wrap my head around it. I didn't really expect things to be like this in my life. And so that by itself is saying an awful lot.
Yeah, right. I mean, this free-floating, sort of ambiguous dread mm-hmm. that some people have is a very common thing.
I feel caught up in something bigger than me. I can't really tell you what it's like. I just have a sense that it's that I've gotten lost in this.
So I'm hearing that a typical session with you anyway. Mm-hmm. That would begin with just this, just as it would with any physician. What's wrong? What's going on in your life?
And what brings you here?
Yeah. How long is a typical one-on-one session?
With me in this inpatient setting, it's usually about an hour.
Yeah.
That'll be several times in a week.
Yeah, yeah. How does except for the obvious, what's the difference between a groups situation, and I know you do groups, mm-hmm. And one-on-one, are people automatically resistant to group therapy?
Generally, most people will often say, "Oh, I don't do groups," because it's intimidating. Though, I would say that the bulk of my patients love group after they really get integrated into it, because it bats away a lot of the stigma that people live with and the sense that I'm in this alone, whereas. You know, you and I might not have the same story, but we can recognize underneath it, to go back to what you said earlier about spirituality, but we experience the same kind of thing at a spiritual level. We've experienced what betrayal is or what regret is, or we experience what it's like to feel discarded. We can experience that together. So group often tends to be, I would think by the end, something that people really, really look forward to and really benefit from.
Should it be a goal of someone in therapy to move from a one-on-one situation to a group situation, or are each individual
different? In our environment, people are doing both. They're in group and
you tell people that ahead of time. This is what we want to do,
and that's just part of our daily schedule. That there are groups and there's individual sessions, and so I'm always, you know, I'm always working with not always, but I'm often working with people who are a little bit resistant. So just getting them to wade in and get themselves involved in group, it's exponential. And actually, we can look at some studies that suggest that group work is exponential in terms of growth, in terms of therapeutic process, which doesn't mean that there's not a place for one-on-one work. There are certain things that we work with one-on-one that we might never bring into a group setting.
Yeah, that group dynamic is what is, I guess, the foundation of things like AA.
Certainly.
I mean, that is the only thing that distinguishes it from anything else, is that it's a community of like-minded individuals.
Certainly. And I would say that in some ways, AA is kind of a layperson's cognitive behavioral therapy.
There you go.
It's really kind of a lay CBT.
It is. It is that. Now I want to get into when we decided that you come on the show, you said you could do it. I wanted to share with you the article I'd seen recently in the newspaper with regard to the rise of self-harm. Mm-hmm. The article dealt with adolescence, and we'll find out whether that's strictly the case here now. But is that your experience? That first of all, let's find out what self-harm. When we say people are self-harming themselves, what do you mean?
Okay, you have to separate that from suicidal actions, though that obviously is a form of self-harm. But I think what we're often talking about are physical acts that cause harm to the body. Okay, so we're often thinking about cutting. That is probably the most common form that people are usually thinking about when they're referring to self-harm. There can be other kinds of things too: burning yourself, biting self. Picking at your body. So the whole realm, there's a range of those kinds of things. And I would not want to separate suicidality outside of that, but when we're talking about self-harm, we're usually thinking about this and talking about suicidality as like a little somewhat separate.
Yeah, we're going to get specific about what the relationship is between self-harm as an indicator for potential suicide or attempts in a moment. But am I right in assuming that the difference between someone who is self-harming and someone who is suicidal? Suicide seeks to end the feelings, and self-harm is sort of perpetuating feelings in a perverse way.
I think that's a fair distinction. Suicidal acts have at least as their stated interest to end all of this. So there's a real finite kind of goal. Whereas self-harm tends to be a more ongoing kind of activity that I actually find relief in. I find some kind of escape in it. Sometimes that might be a matter of if I'm really experiencing overwhelming numbness, I feel something. For others, if I'm feeling overwhelming despair and dread and pain, I feel something different from that. I think one of the interesting things is, you know, our skin is very precise in terms of its pain sensors, in terms of its relating pain. You can very, very accurately identify where on my body am I experiencing pain. Whereas whether internally, if I'm experiencing some kind of pain in my mouth, it's difficult to gauge, is that in my jaw? Is that in my tooth? Is that in a muscle? It's just less discriminate. And so I think one of the things that happens with so much self-harm is it's very specific.
And you localize the problem.
You localize it, and that also gives me a sense of great power.
Right. If the problem is in your mind, you can't localize that. It's everywhere. But if you can focus into a part of your body, mm-hmm. and this is where I'll make it stop here. So who are what sort of people do this?
Pretty much anybody. Years ago, I think the stereotype was adolescent girls, and that's hardly a viable stereotype any longer. Certainly beginning in adolescence, but that tends to be just the age of onset, whereas adults can also be cutting or burning or other kinds of self-harm.
Is excessive things like this, piercing and even tattoos, is that a form? Could that be a form of self-harm?
Potentially, I suspect. However, I think that there's often, I suspect there might be a small segment that we could branch off and saying that there's some kind of self-harm there. However, because I know that there some people have a real fascination with just more and more ink, more and more ink.
Yeah.
I think we probably have to separate that off a little bit. Because that often tends to be more of an expression, and again, a lot of times it has a sense of power that goes along with it.
In your experience of treating, and I know you've treated people with, mm-hmm. and in fact, it's no longer an uncommon situation. Is there a relationship? No, it's not a relationship. But can self-harm be addictive in itself? In other words, people just addicted to doing it.
Well, I mean, I think if we pull addiction back to kind of its underwriting focus, which is compulsion. I do something, though it's not rational. I do this even though I don't feel like I have power or control over it. And in that realm, and I get some kind of rewards for it. Mm-hmm. They might be diminishing rewards, but I'm still compelled. And in that form, I think that a lot of self-harm would share some real commonality because it doesn't add up that I find this to be rewarding. It doesn't add up that I get relief from this, and yet,
I do
despite other kinds of negative consequences, I continue to do it. So, there does seem to be a sense of I get caught up in something bigger than myself that drives me towards this.
Yeah, and we're going to take a break here in a minute, but this final one, when we go back to the issue of young people about this, from the article I read, and I know you've seen this as well, this behavior, self-harming, because of a multitude of factors, not least of which is social media, can now become an identifying trademark of the person. In other words, this is who I am, and I have all these other people online that do it as well. That's going on too, isn't it?
Certainly, certainly.
And that's nothing but a danger.
I would agree.
We were focusing at the end here of the program on this notion of self-harm, inspired by an article we saw where it's rising. Is that your experience? You see it rising?
I've seen it rise across the last decade
or
so.
Yeah.
At least my awareness of it.
Yeah. Before we get into treating it, just this one last point about this, because it seems it's so counterintuitive that someone would cut themselves or burn themselves. The process there is just to feel something? Is that what's going on here?
Well, I suspect there's several different responses. One is to feel something. Another is to feel something different. And a third might be that I actually have some power and control over what I'm doing with my body, what I'm doing with my life.
So it's not simply or easily described as people who don't like themselves.
I would suspect that self-loathing might have a role for some, but it probably has more to do with how am I learning how to cope with what I'm experiencing.
Yeah, because there are lots of ways to manifest that you don't feel good about yourself that don't involve burning, cutting your body. So I think sometimes we tend to go, well, they just don't like themselves. How do you go about treating something like this?
Sure, and I think we have to recognize a kind of a compulsive level, which is one dynamic. Another is just looking at how I perceive myself, perceive what's going on around me, recognizing how I'm thinking about things. And a third would be anchoring around how do I find power to really enact and engage in my life? So kind of historically, there are two primary therapeutic modalities, dialectical behavioral therapy and CBT, which is DBT, and cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, which have been utilized pretty extensively. Dialectical is really looking at behaviors and trying to evaluate and analyze the behaviors that I'm involved in. Cognitive behavioral therapy really is looking at the thoughts, how I'm perceiving things. And then the third is one that we utilize also at retreat. It really actually makes up the bulk of our weekend curriculum, is ACT, or Acceptance Commitment Therapy, which is less invested in understanding how I'm thinking, less invested in really analyzing my behaviors, but really looking at why do I think this way? What's the function of it? Why do I behave this way? What's the function of that? And then restoring me and turning to look at how do I escape my experience and how do I return to the key values, the key commitments, the key convictions I have about who I am and what I've learned about myself, where I really feel connected to myself, where I recognize myself.
Those key commitments you just mentioned are, again, sort of circling back to this notion of something outside yourself, something spiritual.
Well, some of it is actually just very much internal to myself. Right. These are the things that make me who I am.
How effective are these self-harmers in hiding it? I mean, particularly young people, are they good at hiding? Because it's physical. You can see it on their body, right?
Certainly. And there's both the attempts to hide and the attempts to display.
Actually, they want you to see this?
Certainly. And, you know, there are certain kind of badges of honor, I guess, or badges of identity, that I'm part of a group that has scarring. I'm part of a group that has, I identify with other people, because it does suggest we're part of something. We have some kind of common experience where in society, in this world, that this is how we've responded to it. So there is kind of that dimension of actually wanting to display. Now that might be kind of chosen, where I display my scars or where I display these things,
so that they fit into a social strata somewhere. I fit somewhere.
Right.
I'm the person that cuts myself.
Sure. Which also feeds back to that again is working for me. I'm finding connection where I was not finding connection, or I'm finding connection where I feel like I can be authentic and real, as opposed to where I'm needing to pose and present a facade.
We can take a moment here before we say goodbye and talk about young people again. I'm going to circle back to that. For parents or family members who worry that they may have a young person who is either doing it or inclined to do it, what do you advise them to be doing?
I think the first is not to overreact, which is so much easier said than done.
How do you not overreact to someone cutting themselves?
I'm not sure I've got really great advice for that, except take a breath. And I would encourage to approach that not punitively, not condemningly. Obviously, we speak in so many ways. We communicate in so many ways. So I think you look at cutting as one more form of communication and understand it as such.
And not rush to the conclusion that they're going to kill themselves.
This by itself is enough of a concern. And how do we respond? Responding to that, trying to communicate safety with the parent, and recognizing that this is often an attempt for me to survive. Okay? It's actually an attempt to cope. Suicidality is not so much an attempt to cope.
No, right.
Okay? Now, I'm not going to say that it can't be correlated. There are some suggestions that self-harm, people who self-harm have a higher probability of moving to suicidality at some point. But I don't think that's a clear one-to-one correlation.
Yeah, yeah. No, the idea that it's a cry for help should be very obvious in a lot of situations. Tom Longenecker, thanks so much, Tom. We want to have you back lots because it's a big topic.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
We appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us on Recovery Radio, brought to you by Retreat Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one is in need of help, their admissions office is available 24/7 at 855-859-8808. That's 855-859-8808.